Hello, and welcome to the Jury Room. I'm your host, Kevin, and I will be covering anything true crime, from serial killers to cold cases, and everything in between. The Jury Room podcast is available on most major podcasting platforms. Don't forget to like, subscribe, follow anywhere you can. Stay safe, and thanks for listening.
The Oracle Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige. Today, I'll be talking about Daryl Abbott, Pantera, Damage Plan, Aaron Hawk, Nathan Bray, Jeff Thompson, Nathan Gale, and the horrible, upsetting event that shook concert goers and live performers alike to their core. I think a lot of us look at all murderers as evil people without a soul. While sometimes that might be the case, some people have extreme mental health conditions, and no one around them that takes care of them makes sure they get the help that they need. And if by chance they do get the help, and they get put on medication, the people that are around them and in their lives aren't always going to make sure that they're taking their medicine as they should. Mental health is a big issue, and sometimes situations like the one in today's episode are more complicated than we may realize, and it can be an uncomfortable experience to really sit back and think about a killer as a human being in a lot of cases, and I get that. This is not in any way an excuse or a pass for people with mental illnesses to murder anyone. Not in the slightest. I'm only stating that when mental illnesses are not treated, things like this, unfortunately, can and do happen. It would be a lot easier if it didn't cost an arm and a leg for people to get mental help, too. Of course, that topic is a bigger discussion altogether. Nobody deserved to die that night. Nobody is at fault for what this man did. I know it's not our job to babysit grown adults who are on medication, and we can't control what they do if they're not in our care. This is one case that is pretty depressing across the board, honestly. Nobody thinks their family member or friend would ever kill someone, and nobody expects their loved one to be a murder victim. When we go out to have a good time at a bar, a venue, or any type of event, we don't think about some random person might rush in and start shooting. But that is precisely the heartbreaking, traumatizing tragedy that happened on December 8th, 2004. Let's get started. For those of you who may not know who Daryl Dimebag Abbott is and his background, I do want to go through that. He was born Daryl Lance Abbott in Texas on August 20th, 1966. He was the baby of the family and had an older brother named Vinnie Paul. Their parents were Carolyn and Jerry Abbott. Jerry was a country music producer. Even though their parents split up in 1979 after being married for 17 years, it wasn't like the terrible situations we usually hear about. The family was still in a positive place, and everyone handled things pretty well. Daryl and Vinnie resided with their mom in Arlington, Texas. Both boys were very much into music and wanted to get into the music scene. Both parents were extremely supportive of their sons. Daryl picked up a guitar and started trying to play at 12 years old. For those of you who are into guitars, on his 12th birthday, he was gifted a Les Paul-style Hondo and a pig-nose amplifier. Daryl would get in front of his mirror, like most of us at that age, goofing around and holding his guitar, wearing the type of makeup that Kiss wears. He was musically inspired by Kiss, as well as Black Sabbath, Van Halen, and Judas Priest. He couldn't actually play the guitar at this time yet, so he started to get his dad, Jerry, to teach him how to play. His dad would teach Daryl Kiss songs, because he knew how much he loved the band, which I think is so sweet. Jerry would also bring him along to the studio, where Daryl would watch and learn from many country music performers. Before Daryl received his first guitar, his brother Vinny had been playing drums for a while. Daryl attempted to play the drums, but I guess he wasn't very good at it, with Vinny later saying, quote, "I just got better than him and wouldn't let him play them anymore." Daryl and Vinny teamed up for the first time just for fun, jamming out together, and played Smoke on the Water for over 6 hours. When they began playing music together and realized they jived so well, Vinny said from that moment on, they were practically fused together at the hip. Beyond exciting for the now 14-year-old Daryl, his mom took him to the Agora Ballroom in Dallas, where he had entered a guitar contest. One of the judges being the founder of Dean Guitars, Dean Zielinski. That had to be exhilarating and nerve-wracking, but Daryl was completely victorious, winning the contest. Dean said that he blew everyone away. Daryl went on to win so many contests that he was made a judge instead of a competitor to give others a chance to win for a change. Vinny's high school friends, Terry Glaze, Tommy Bradford, and Donnie Hart, asked Vinny to join their band. He said he would, but only if Daryl could join as well. Terry said they weren't too sure about this because they thought Daryl wasn't that great, plus he was 2 years younger, and they called him a little skinny, scrawny dude. However, they decided it was cool, and Pantera was born in 1981. Only a year later, Pantera's vocalist, Donnie Hart, decided to part ways with the band, and Terry Glaze took over the part of vocalist, and Rex Brown was now the bassist, taking Tommy Bradford's place. Over 6 months, Daryl was so skilled on the guitar that he was now the lead guitarist instead of just playing alongside Terry. Kiss has a song called Black Diamond, and inspired by that, Daryl's stage name at the time was Diamond Daryl. Pantera started off as a glam metal band. They were decked out in spandex, makeup, and you better believe a lot of hairspray while they performed. Daryl was only 16 when Pantera's first album, Metal Magic, dropped in 1983. 16. That is impressive. Continuing to release albums in 1984 and 85, still glam metal, they were compared to Motley Crue. They would go on to make heavier music as their career progressed. Daryl and Vinny started loving Metallica and Slayer, which inspired the heavier sound. Terry didn't really like the idea of going heavy metal, saying, quote, "I didn't want to go that heavy. I didn't like it as well if the guitar was the main thing, like the Metallica songs." Terry ended up leaving Pantera in 1986 because they just couldn't seem to agree on what direction they wanted to take the music. Phil Anselmo took his place later that year. So the band was on a mission to distance themselves from glam metal music. They were rejected from a few record labels, but finally hit it big, getting a major label deal with Atco Records, because the talent scout for the label was blown away by how incredible Pantera was live. Well, Daryl was asked to join the band Megadeth in 1989, but he also said, as his brother did when joining Pantera, that he would only join if Vinnie could be a part of the band as well. They already had a drummer and didn't want to hire Vinnie, so Daryl turned it down and continued with Pantera. On July 24th, 1990, is when the album Cowboys from Hell was released, and that's the sound that Pantera is known for. It was more in the category of power groove and groove metal. It's got the energy of thrash metal, but it's played just a little slower. Pantera's newer sound was because of Daryl and Vinny's adoration of ZZ Top. During the tours in the 90s, Daryl was known as the Wild One and called a heavy drinker. When the album Vulgar Display of Power came out, Daryl modified his look, and that would become what we all know today when we think of Daryl. The goatee, a razor blade accessory, which was a nod to Judas Priest's British Steel. The cargo shorts and sleeveless tops. At this time, he no longer was feeling the stage name Diamond Daryl, and that's when he started going by Dimebag Daryl. It was basically an indication that he didn't buy any more than a dime bag of weed, which, for those that don't know, is $10 worth. He didn't even accept more than that when people would try to give it to him for free, because he didn't want to be caught with it. There was a major shift in the band's life, because up until 1994, all of Pantera's albums were recorded in Daryl and Vinny's dad, Jerry's studio, called Pantego or Pantego Sound. It was right by their house and so convenient. Jerry shortly closed the studio after Vulgar Display of Power came out. He went to Nashville, Tennessee, and launched a new studio called Abtrax. Jerry desired so badly to make his dream come true, which was being a writer of country songs. So the band's album, Far Beyond Driven, was made in the new studio. The band was going back and forth to Nashville and staying in Nashville for weeks at a time. They were in a new place and their routine was all thrown off, so they would all go to each other's hotel rooms and they started doing drugs. The lead singer, Phil, was having chronic back pain, which inspired the song I'm Broken, which was from the new album at the time, Far Beyond Driven. To alleviate some of that pain, Phil started to drink a lot, take painkillers, and then heroin. He began wanting to be alone and got his own tour bus, and he wouldn't come out until about 30 minutes before they were all due to hit the stage. He started interrupting the shows to rant and rave. It caused a lot of stress and tension between all the band members. They started to record the next album separately, except Daryl, Vinny, and Rex. They recorded together in a studio called Chasin' Jason. Daryl made this studio in a barn in his backyard. Phil was recording at Trent Reznor's studio in New Orleans. The first time Daryl picked up a 12-string guitar, he wrote the song Suicide Note Part 1 in 1996. One tidbit that I thought was really sweet was Daryl wrote this solo outro for the song, Floods, way before Phil joined the band, and he had actually recorded an hour and 30 minute loop of this as a lullaby for his girlfriend. Part of this solo outro that he had recorded ended up being used in the song Suicide Note Part 1, I believe. On July 13th, 1996, Phil was still using heroin and suffered an overdose following a performance at the Dallas Starplex Amphitheater. 4 to 5 minutes, he was clinically dead. Phil did bounce back from it and got back on his feet faster than expected. 2 days later, he was back out on the stage performing. However, his overdose caused more friction within the band that would always be there from that point forward. Phil also made his own side projects, and Daryl was completely supportive of that, and it didn't bother anyone in the band. They understood that he was a musical man, and he always wanted to be working. Things started to get worse when Pantera started touring for the Great Southern Trendkill. At that time, they were recording for their next album, Reinventing the Steel, and it was awfully problematic. In an interview after Reinventing the Steel came out, Vinny said, quote, "It was like pulling teeth to get Phil down to the studio. He didn't like any of the material, and it was always just like this headbutting contest," end quote. Sadly, during the recording of the album, Daryl and Vinny's mom, Carolyn, had been diagnosed with lung cancer. On September 12, 1999, 6 weeks after being diagnosed, she passed away. Her death had a significant effect on her sons, but Daryl was taking it the hardest of the two. Pantera was supposed to play a show in Ireland on September 11, 2001, but due to the tragic events of the attack on the Twin Towers, they came back to the States and stayed in Texas. At this time, they took a little break from Pantera. Some members were doing side projects, and Daryl said by 2003, he figured Pantera would regroup. However, Phil did his own thing in 2003, recording his side projects. Around that time, Daryl's phone rang. It was Rex, the bassist, saying he would not be coming back to Pantera. When the band decided to go their separate ways, they released a Greatest Hits album on September 23rd, 2003, which was pretty much their departure album. As always, Daryl and Vinny stuck together. They made their own band and started recording in the studio in the backyard in February of 2003. Members of the new band were vocalist Patrick Lachman, or Latchman, Bob Kakaha was the bassist, and they signed a deal with Elektra Records later in 2003. The new name of the band was Damage Plan, and it was in full effect. All of 2004, Damage Plan had their Devastation Across the Nation tour to start re-establishing their fan base. They had big plans for a new album, but unfortunately, this would never come to fruition due to the horrifying event that happened during a show in Columbus, Ohio, in the Alrosa Villa nightclub on December 8, 2004. Now, I want to take a few minutes to tell you about today's sponsor. This episode is sponsored by SmartAssAndSass.com. And you really do need this adorable and sassy subscription box, and let me tell you why. You'll have snark and sarcasm delivered monthly when you go to smartassandsass.com and use the code TRUECRIME10 for a discount on the subscription box of your choice. I want to tell y'all about what came in my subscription boxes so you can get an idea of what they have. I got a beautiful eyeshadow palette, an eye mask that's like an energy drink for your eyes, a tumbler that says punch today in the face, amazing socks that say 100% that bitch, a cute bandeau headband that is colorful, but if you look closely, it has middle fingers on it, and it's so awesome, I love it. A koozie that I'm using right now that says my soul's too lit to give a shit. A detox bubble bath called Breathe Bitch, and it helps remove pollutants, and it softens and soothes dry, irritated skin, and relaxes the senses to help relieve aches and pains, and you soak in this glorious 100% natural dead sea salt and rosebuds for 10 or 15 minutes. Also, there's a super cute swear jar with a cork top and a slit to put your money, and on the jar it says, "My fucking swear jar." One of my favorites is a cute navy and baby pink handbag with a tassel that says, "Don't kill my vibe," and I'll be carrying that everywhere. There's so many kick-ass and adorable products. I wish I had time to talk about everything in my boxes, but there's one more I do want to mention, and it's a deck of cards called the Rebel Deck, with a unicorn on the box, and it is the Oracle Deck with Attitude. Zero filter and zero fucks equals all fun. The Rebel Deck messages are quick, dirty, and direct. This deck gives the ancient art of divination a modern makeover and adds a little insult to insight. Ask the cards what you need to know. You may get a card that says, for example, detox, and when you turn it over, it'll tell you to drink a smoothie, unfriend that asshole, and throw some shit out. I'll post pictures on my socials so you can see everything that I received from smartassandsass.com. Now, all you have to do is go to smartassandsass.com, pick your subscription box, choose a payment plan, and continue to be your sasshole self and wait for your monthly box to arrive. Each month, you'll get 8 or 9 items, and I know you'll love them. Plus, these Smartass and Sass subscription boxes are valued at $90 or more per box, but because this company is so wonderful, their subscription boxes start as low as $34.95, and when my listeners use the code TRUECRIME10, you'll get a discount. So go grab your box today at smartassandsass.com. That's smartassandsass.com, and use the code TRUECRIME10 for a discount on your subscription box. Now, let's dig a little into the background of a man named Nathan Gale that would later destroy lives in that nightclub and devastate so many that love Daryl and his music. Nathan Miles Gale was born on September 11, 1979, in Lansing, Illinois. He was the baby of the family, being the last born with two older siblings. His parents, Mary and Gerald, had split before moving to Marysville, Ohio. At first, as a preteen, he was going to Benjamin Logan Elementary in fifth grade. The teachers and administrators were catching on quickly that he had mental health problems and a learning disability. Nathan was placed in special education classes. As a freshman in high school, he was able to get out of the special ed classes. While he was a 10th grader, his mom was going through her second divorce, and he started acting out and getting into trouble. He skipped 33 days of school. Going into 11th grade, he relocated to Marysville High School. Nathan was also going to Ohio High Point Joint Vocational School. There, he was learning how to be successful in construction and electrical work. He graduated in 1998 with training in how to be an electrician. However, he became a drug addict while off and on working jobs at minimum wage. Nathan was still residing with his mom, Mary. He was very paranoid due to abusing drugs and claimed that his mom was constantly watching him. But she says that's not true at all. It was the drugs making him think outlandish things. Nathan was living it up with his friends, of course still doing drugs, having jam sessions with them, and hanging out. Which a lot of teenagers and young adults do go through this defiant and nonconformist phase in their life. But Nathan was much different. One of his friends said that he was hyper by nature, but that he would start rocking back and forth really fast, and this friend started to recognize, quote, "That's how crazy people rock." The situation at home was getting really bad, to the point that Nathan was getting violent with his mother, and because of that, she kicked him out of the house. He didn't have anywhere to go, and he was homeless. Nathan did go to rehab for drugs, and after that, Mary let him come back home. In 1997, Nathan was given a citation for criminal trespassing and for skateboarding at a Kmart store. In 1999, he was in trouble for constantly using the park as his sleeping grounds. Nathan was charged in 2000 for being in possession of a set of scales that were stolen from the construction company that he worked for. Therefore, to no surprise, he was fired from his job. Nathan joined the U.S. Marine Corps in February of 2002. Mary was over the moon about him going into the military. She believed this was such a great move for him and that he had kicked his drug habit. While he was in the Marines, he kept trying to meet the weight requirements and couldn't, constantly being yelled at by his instructors. Christmas of 2002, his mom even bought him a gun, which would later be a huge mistake that she could have never known would be, and she does blame herself a lot for it. Nathan took his physical fitness and marksmanship test, and he aced them. On April 1st, 2003, he was promoted to Lance Corporal. Less than halfway of his four-year allegiance, and while he was in the middle of a war, October or November of 2003, Nathan was hit with an administrative discharge. The Marine Corps would not disclose why he was let go, with their reasoning being the rules of privacy. However, Nathan told his mom and others that he was discharged for being diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic. The Department of Veteran Affairs did get a job for him as a mechanic after he was discharged. His boss, Rich, did also confirm that Nathan told him he was a paranoid schizophrenic. Mary had her suspicions that her son wasn't taking medication for it. Her suspicions were right. When he was discharged, he didn't have any money and didn't seek any kind of treatment. When his friend Ryan asked him, "Why did you get discharged?" Nathan giggled. Ryan said, "Well, did you like it?" Nathan replied, "Not really, but I learned how to blow stuff up, got to shoot a rocket launcher and some guns." Ryan said, "It did make me feel weird because he said it with that Nate kind of giggle, and he was the last person you want to teach how to blow shit up." Nathan and his mom moved into an apartment. He was trying to get on his feet, and the Veterans Administration did just get him a job at the Minute Lube. Even though Rich was the boss, he tried the best he could to be his mentor and guide him in a good direction. Nathan told Rich that he was taking medication for his schizophrenia, but that's not known he was for sure at the time. However, Rich did say that he was great with customers and children. Rich would talk to Nathan about hockey, and he really started taking an interest in it. Rich even took him to a few Blue Jackets games. He was trying so hard to be a positive role model for Nathan, and it seemed to be working. Nathan even started wanting to get involved in sports. Standing 6 feet tall and a little over 250 pounds, he made a great offensive lineman for a semi-professional football team, and would crank up Pantera's music to get pumped up for the games. He was a huge Pantera fan since he was in high school. He continued to have an unhealthy obsession with the band, even after Pantera broke up. Even a friend of his at the time, named Dave, had a band, and Nathan wanted to practice songs he said were original music that he had written. Dave was all for it. But then one of the band members realized the lyrics were Pantera's, not Nathan's at all. Nathan even stated that Pantera stole his lyrics. He was going to sue them, and they were attempting to take his identity. Nathan's friend Dave began backing away from him and slowly cutting him off because he knew Nathan was getting worse, even talking about murdering people. He was acting bizarre, staring at walls while talking to himself, and played with a dog that wasn't even there. His other friend, Mark, said, quote, "He told me once that God told him to kill Marilyn Manson." Many other people witnessed this same strange conduct. He was never popular with the ladies, and so many people would make fun of him. In November of 2004, he was taken to jail for driving with a suspended license. His criminal record was no secret, but his crimes had never been vicious ones. At some point in the fall, things started to slowly fall apart. His mom moved in with her new boyfriend, which left Nathan to pay the rent on his own. He was still working at Minute Lube, and Saturdays happened to be the day everyone would come into the store, and it was super busy. But he needed Saturdays off to keep up with his football games. Eventually, he gave up his job for football. He worked a few jobs here and there, but he would either leave or get fired. In December, Nathan was working at another construction site and was still living by himself. His anger was still brewing about Pantera's breakup in 2003. Nathan took it personally. His friend Mark said, quote, "When they broke up, I think he felt some kind of personal connection, like he felt left out or betrayed. This kid listened to their albums every day. He was obsessed with Pantera." So all of these negative feelings were constantly piling up on 25-year-old Nathan. Everything anyone said to him, he would call them liars and throw temper tantrums. There were theories floating around about something else that could have upped his rage even more. The vocalist, Phil, did an interview with Metal Hammer magazine, saying, quote, "Daryl deserves to be beaten severely." Through all of these hard times for Nathan, struggling with his mental health and being quite unstable, some sources say that he and his mom were super close. However, a close friend of Nathan's said there was a lot of friction between the two, stating that his mom always told him to, quote, "Shut the fuck up and get out of my face." going on to say that it really didn't seem like there was a lot of love between Nathan and Mary. December 8, 2004, after Nathan put on his blue and white hockey jersey over his hooded sweatshirt with the Columbus Blue Jackets hockey team logo on the front, put on his glasses, which were so thick that he got picked on in the Marines with people saying they were birth control glasses. Nathan went on his way to the Damage Plan concert at the Al Rosa Village nightclub. He got to the nightclub early, sitting outside in his 1995 Pontiac Grand Am, thinking of what was to come for hours. Security guards came out at least 3 times, making him get his car out of the way until Nathan finally parked by the tour bus, which was by the back entrance of the club. He finally exited his vehicle and started walking back and forth. He kept asking a security guard named Jeffrey, who comes back later, if by chance Daryl and Vinny might be in the tour bus. A lot of people couldn't help but notice him walking around the parking lot, and they were wondering what he was doing. When the opening band started to play, someone told Nathan he might want to come on inside to hear the band play, but Nathan said, quote, "I don't care about local bands." After he was told that Daryl and Vinny were probably already in the club, he walked at a fast pace to get into the show. He jumped a fence to get over to the patio section outside of the club and made a dash for the door. He heard the crowd going bananas over Damage Plan taking the stage, and he took off sprinting. While they started to play the first song, Nathan ran onto the stage with a Beretta 92FS, which had 2 clips, and he was carrying about 30 extra bullets in his pocket. When he first soared onto the stage, people thought it was just a random kid wanting to party and crowd surf. But it took a turn when he stood in front of the drum riser and came out from behind a 7-foot pile of amplifiers, shouting either, "You broke up Pantera," or "This is for breaking up Pantera." And then he shot Daryl Dimebag Abbott at least 4 times in the back of the head. When Jeffrey Thompson, 40 years old, and the band security guard wrestled Nathan to the ground, he was shot and killed in the middle of the tussle. Nathan Bray, 23 years old, and a huge fan from the audience, tried to get to Daryl and help him. Nathan Bray started to perform CPR when he looked right at Nathan Gale. He put his arms up, but he was fatally shot by him too. Also, an RN in the audience, Mindy Reese, jumped to Daryl's aid, saying, quote, "I said, fuck this, I'm a nurse, he needs help. I did chest compressions for 15 to 20 minutes. I kept saying, Dimebag, come on, please stay with me." Daryl was almost gone by the time paramedics arrived. A guy that worked at the club and was a former Marine named Aaron Hawk, 29 years old, attempted to get the gun out of Nathan's grasp as he was reloading it. Unfortunately, he was murdered as well. Several officers snuck into the club in different doors. Cops were surrounding Nathan, and he snatched up John Brooks, the drum technician, who had been shot in the legs, and he used him as a shield. Nathan had shot at least 17 bullets, and had 5 bullets left with a few more in his pockets. There were 2 or 3 others badly injured before one of the police officers backed up towards the stage door, moving the drums out of the way, and shot Nathan Gale in the head. The officer was a little over 20 feet away with his 12-gauge Remington shotgun, and Nathan immediately died. When Nathan collapsed to the ground, all the officer could say was, "I had to do it. I had to do it. I had to do it." While all of this was happening, Vinny had taken off to the tour bus, crawled into Daryl's bunk bed, and cried his eyes out. Daryl was only 38 years old when he lost his life, exactly 24 years after John Lennon was also murdered. Daryl was so young, with so much more to give to the world, and so much life left to live. It was one of the most tragic deaths in music. One of quite a few, I should say. Daryl was declared deceased on the scene. Vinny stated in 2006, quote, "They, the opening band, were doing Parliament songs, heavy metal style, and they were all dressed up like G.I. Joes. We were catching such a nut on them. We were back there doing shots and peeking out and cracking up about the whole thing. So we were all in a good mood and we had a full house that night. And we went up on the deck. And right before we went on, Dime was warming up his hand and putting his lip gloss on. The last thing I ever said to my brother was, 'Van Halen?' And he gives me the five and says, 'Van fucking Halen.' And that was our code word for letting it all hang out and having a good time. And that's the last thing he ever said to me, man. It's insane." This is what I found on the other victims. Aaron Hawk was 29 years old at the time, and his nickname was Stoney. Aaron was a roadie, worked security, and was a former Marine. His brother Andy told the Columbus Dispatch that he was the type of kid who always went out of his way to help people. 23-year-old Nathan Bray was married and had a 2-year-old little boy. He was a major fan of Dimebag Darrell, and he was so excited to see this man that he admired in person. Jeff Thompson was known as Mayhem, and he was 40 years old. He was the head of security for Damage Plan. His friend said that he was 6 feet 8 inches tall and a total gentle giant. Jeff literally told the band members all of the time that he would take a bullet for them. And that gives me chills. The police and investigators couldn't really pin down a certain motive for Nathan's actions. There were only speculations. After his brother's horrible death, Vinny listened to the recording of the interview that Phil gave about Daryl needing to be severely beaten. While Phil said that he was just joking, Vinny stated the way he said it on that recording was not in a joking manner at all. After this, Vinny wanted nothing to do with Phil and never talked to him again that I've seen. Vinny didn't even talk to Rex, the bassist, anymore after this time. Nathan's friends felt a lot of guilt after this happened. They felt like they should have spoken up about their thoughts on Nathan having the capability to be a danger to himself and or others, and Nathan, quote, not being right. Looking back and seeing all the signs, they wish they would have told someone. Nathan's friend Ryan Hughes, that I mentioned earlier, was 26 years old, and he knew Nathan for years. He sighed sadly in disbelief before saying, quote, "You never look at your friend as a mass murderer." Ryan tries to make sense of all of this, attempting to put a human behind who mostly everyone thinks of as an overall evil beast. He said, quote, "You ever read of mice and men? Lenny? That's what Nate was like. He'd come running up to you and you weren't sure if he was going to hug you or snap your neck." Sociologist Donna Gaines said that what Nathan was going through could have a psychological impact similar to that of a parent abandoning a young child. She said, quote, "He's not going to be able to get back on his feet and say, 'Let me see what Pantera's new music is. Maybe I can grow with them.' Or even, 'Fuck them, let me check out Slayer.' He didn't have that. What was at stake was survival, faith, hope, possibility, identification, community." The officer that shot Nathan Gale in the head, a grand jury had to figure out if what he did using deadly force was necessary. The grand jury decided to clear him of any wrongful act in May of 2005. The officer was even thanked and hailed a hero for what he did. America's Most Wanted nominated him for a bravery award. The National Rifle Association declared him the Law Enforcement Officer of the Year in 2005. And Ohio Attorney General Jim Petro gave him the Distinguished Law Enforcement Valor Award. The officer's name was James N. His last name is spelled N-I-G-G-E-M-E-Y-E-R, and I hope you understand that I don't want to fuck his last name up, to be honest with you. After being diagnosed with PTSD in 2007, James retired as a first responder. However, he did work at the robbery division for a bit as a detective before he completely left the police force for good. In 2016, he was still going to therapy, and he had a job with the Columbus's Fleet Management Division. This mass shooting really got people talking at the time about security measures that needed to be taken at all venues. Scott Ian of Anthrax said, quote, "To me, everything changed after Daryl was killed. The stage became off limits for everyone but musicians. I don't give a fuck how much fun you're having. Stay the fuck off the stage." End quote. In 2014, Paul of Cannibal Corpse stated, quote, "I remember us being fully concerned about it. There was beefed up security and a little bit more padding down, but it seems to be more out of sight, out of mind now. Back to normal, in a sense." End quote. Christina Grimmie was a popular YouTuber who would post videos of her playing cover songs, and eventually, she started coming out with her own music. In 2016, Christina was killed in an eerily comparable fashion that Daryl Abbott was, and Pantera spoke up about this. On Facebook, they posted to their page expressing to promoters and people who owned venues to enhance security for people that are on stage. Nathan's mother only ever participated in two interviews, and she was receiving death threats because of what her son did. She said, quote, "Nothing I say about him is going to erase what happened in the end, in those few minutes. I'm sorry for what happened. I'm sorry for those people who were killed. But I lost a son too." Mary said that she will never be able to live it down, that she was the one who gave him the gun as a gift because she was proud of his military service. She also did praise Officer James for doing what he did to save so many more lives that her son could have taken. So she clearly understands why the officer did what he did, but at the same time, she is mourning her son as well. It's just a sad situation all across the board. Vinny sued the club over the loss of his brother. The lawsuit was settled out of court in 2007 for what was labeled at the time as a very small amount of money. There was a private funeral for Nathan. He was cremated, and when the autopsy came back, he didn't have any drugs in his system and no medication for his mental illnesses. He strictly went into the concert off his meds, fueled by his anger and the things in his head that had haunted him. Dimebag Daryl's funeral was a bit hectic. There weren't enough seats, and many of Daryl's family members were taken out of the funeral by security to, quote, make room for distinguished guests, as if the celebrities were more important than the family. During the funeral, a lot of the family members decided to leave because some of the people that were speaking were using profane language. A few months before Daryl lost his life, he heard that Eddie Van Halen and Charvel guitars were collaborating to make this limited edition collection of guitars that would have Van Halen's trademark tape striping, with Van Halen taping every guitar himself. The person who was lucky enough to get one of these guitars would even get a picture of Eddie himself taping the guitars, plus a certificate of authenticity. Eddie said that Daryl called him one day and asked if he could buy one of the guitars before they were available to the public. Eddie told Daryl that the next time he saw him, he would have one of the guitars with him and would stripe it while he was hanging out with Daryl as a present. How adorable is that? Seriously. Unfortunately, they wouldn't meet again before Daryl died. Eddie told this story when he spoke at Daryl's funeral, and then, to everyone's surprise, he brought out the black and yellow tape-striped guitar, which is on the back of the cover of Van Halen 2. And it was extremely special because Daryl had said that was his favorite guitar of Eddie's. Eddie Van Halen placed it in Daryl's casket so it could be buried with him. Daryl Dimebag Abbott was buried at the Moore Memorial Garden Cemetery in Arlington, Texas, on October 6, 2020, at the age of 65. Eddie Van Halen passed away of a stroke, and I can only imagine that Eddie and Daryl are up there somewhere on the other side, rocking out together. Also alongside Daryl's brother Vinny, who passed away on June 22, 2018, it was due to a coronary artery disease and a group of diseases that affect the heart muscle. May they all rest in peace. December 8, 2014, Channel 10 WBNS reported, quote, despite a drizzle and temperatures in the 40s, more than 200 people turned up for a vigil Thursday night in the club's parking lot. Sean Sweeney, 22 years old, played old school Pantera on an acoustic guitar, and a half dozen young men held up a blue tarp over his head and sang along. Referring to the growing crowd, Sweeney said, "This is beautiful. This is absolutely beautiful." My thoughts and prayers go out to all of the families and friends that were affected by this awful tragedy and lost a loved one. I hate that this happened, and I know that this was really a huge punch in the gut to so many people in the music industry and a lot of us as well. And I really do send out my thoughts and prayers to Nathan's family because they deserve it. They lost a son. He was sick. And I think the stigma of mental health issues needs to go away. If you or someone you know is in need of help, I will have numbers to hotlines in the show notes. Please use them if you need to. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Until next time, Everyone, take care of yourselves and stay safe. I love you.